This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket with me, Simon Hughes, and Simon Mann's back with us today as well. We have a special guest. I'll introduce him in just a moment. But of course, we're all catching our breath with that amazing performance by the Lionesses last night to see England's triumph in the Euro final, which was a riveting experience. I just thought the skill levels was phenomenal. I've been watching those girls train actually at the local Lensbury Health Club in Twickenham, Teddington sort of area, and the emphasis, the quality, the intensity of their training has really been exceptional, and obviously reflected in the way they played. So a fantastic experience, and I'll introduce our special guest. It's the former Hampshire captain and of course renowned broadcaster and co-founder of the charity Chance to Shine, Mark Nicholas, a great old colleague of mine. We first met actually playing for Middlesex under-19s way back in the 1970s, which seems a long time ago now. And Mark, I just want to ask you something about the football. You have a daughter. Did she watch it with you? What did she make of it, if so?
Well, she didn't watch it because she's not here. She's on holiday with some friends.
But what would she have made of it, do you think?
She's quite got into women's tennis as against men's, you know what I mean? As opposed to just liking tennis, full stop. Because we went to Wimbledon a couple of years ago and she was absolutely riveted by Serena Williams. Riveted. I mean, she couldn't believe her movement and power, and that sort of got her into it. I think she'd have enjoyed it. I can't believe anybody wouldn't have enjoyed that last night. I think your point about the skill is interesting. I mean, technically, the girls play well, and I think that they're particularly their sort of short passing in triangles, almost the old ticker-tacker stuff, they do very well. And then there was the Kane-Son goal, that first goal. It was a classic Harry Kane pass for Son to run onto, and the girls matched it, you know, and the grand finale and the joy. I mean, it's up there, isn't it? You know, we've now had two women's teams win World Cups in cricket and soccer, and they've brought as much joy as anybody else winning anything, partly because people are more impressed by the standard of play and partly because it rids them of the stigma and the discrimination, and that's the best thing ever. I think probably the football is a bit more surprising. I've never been surprised that women would be good at cricket, because cricket is every bit as much a game of touch and timing as it is of power. So I can see that that works. I was surprised that the footballers had the level of technique. I think that's probably what I enjoyed the most. Yeah,
yeah, I agree with you. You betrayed a little bit of your allegiance to Spurs there, which I share. So, Simon, you've got two daughters. Mm. So tell us what they made of it.
Well, they both watched it. Well, one of them is on holiday a long way away. She watched it, enjoyed it, apparently. And the other one, yeah, watched it as well and was delighted afterwards and gave me the details of what she'd seen and how she'd reacted to it. So, yeah, I think actually the biggest cheer at Southampton yesterday in that England T20 match came when the first England goal went in as well. I think it overrode everything else that was going on at Southampton. The crowds watching and following it down there. It actually sort of masked what was quite a miserable day for England, wasn't it, in the T20. And well played South Africa, but yeah, England got some work to do.
Somebody stuck in traffic trying to get here to talk to you guys. I was talking to somebody who left the ground early, a couple who left the ground early, as England were falling apart in the cricket to get home and watch the soccer. And they were leaving the ground to hear the roar. They wanted to see the second half, and they got stuck getting out, so they didn't, but they saw extra time in the end. But they heard that roar and they were telling me about it. They said it was the biggest roar of the day.
It's amazing, isn't it, how England have managed to almost sail under the radar, the cricketers, I mean, And if you're going to lose rather sadly to South Africa in a T20 international series, do it while there's an England women's football final going on. And then obviously, you know, people haven't noticed. But what did you make of England's T20 performances? You have an interesting perspective on it because you work for the South African TV networks, SuperSport, covering their domestic and international cricket. So you have a sort of an interesting kind of twin view on it, really.
Well, I mean, I think nothing lasts forever. And, you know, England have just got to find the reset button. You lose a powerful character like Owen Morgan and everything changes immediately. There's never been, I can't think there's ever been a team that's had a very powerful leader, all powerful, I would say. And that person's left and the team's continued in the same vein. It's pretty rare. And I think it's proven strongly in the makeup of that side. Then you take out Ben Stokes, don't consider Joe Root in that format of the game. A couple of people out of form, bowlers injured. You know, it's nowhere near England's best side. Jos Buttler clearly finding it difficult to play with the same freedom and expression as captain and was due a bad run. He's had such an extraordinary run in that format of the game. I always think it's remarkable to have such a run in that format of the game. You'd think eventually he wouldn't quite time one and he'd be caught somewhere in the deep or nick one, but he had an amazing run. So they've got a lot of thinking to do. Is Buttler the right guy to captain? Not because Butler's necessarily a flawed character, more that the burden of wicket-keeping, opening the batting and captaining is very demanding mentally. So that's an issue. As I say, it's a reset button. One, you know, there are candidates, aren't there? Moeen Ali is a candidate to captain the side. James Vince is surely a candidate to captain short-form cricket, given what he's done for Hampshire. So there are options out there. South Africa, don't underestimate them. Every time I go to South Africa, I come home thinking the same thing. Just when you think maybe the force is no longer with them in cricket, the opposite is proven. I mean, their performances last winter against India were extraordinary. They beat India in the Test series, having lost the first Test. Three Test series, they won two in a row by 7 wickets. And then they hammered them 3-0 in the one-day series. I mean, you know, you've got to be good at cricket to do that. So don't underestimate South Africa. They've got a lot of natural match winners. They love playing hardcore cricket. They love pressure moments. I never got over this whole thing of the choker thing and blowing it in quarterfinals and semifinals. I just don't get that. That is not the mental framework of South African sport.
As proved by their rugby team, of course.
Yes, I just don't understand it, really. I think probably when you look back and trace, particularly the semi-finals, you can find reasons, whether it be extraordinary brilliance from Shane Warne, for example, problems with selection based on the quota system in 2015 in Australia. There, you can trace little things that have proved awkward hurdles, I think, for them to get over on the eve or during a match itself. And we've seen Warne do that. I mean, Warne's performance in 99 at Edgbaston in that remarkable match, I think that whatever they say about the high-scoring game, the 4-3-4 game, or 4-3-8 game, whichever we're going to call it, I still think the Australia-South Africa semi-final of 99 was the greatest one-day match ever played, beating even the England-New Zealand World Cup final. I think they're the three greatest. And I think that semi-final was extraordinary and took Warne to win it. So whether you say South Africa choked, or just you say one genius won it. I mean, it's like George Best scoring a hat-trick in the last 4 minutes, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's kind of... Sorry, that is winding back the clock to our beginning.
No, it's a good segue because Simon Mann was on commentary for that final moment in the semi-final, weren't you, Simon?
I was. I mean, I agree with Mark. I think it was one of the great, well, one if not the greatest one-day international I've ever seen. I mean, absolutely stunning game of cricket. I mean, Gibbs was winning it for South Africa. He got off to a great start. They're only chasing just over 200 to win. and then you get amazing climax, brilliant bowling from Shane Warne. Yeah, I mean, it was just everything you could want in a game of cricket was there that day, and it's hard to better a game like that. I thought it was an interesting thing Mark said, actually, about coming away from South Africa and sort of thinking, oh, their cricket is on a bit of a slump. Because actually, the last time I went to South Africa, just before the pandemic, I felt that really strongly. England won the Test series there. I thought it looked a poor South African Test side. I know they won the first Test. England, they drew the one day because one game was rained off. And England won the T20s. They won in sort of rollicking fashion at Centurion with Morgan whacking it over the boundary. And I thought, I remember saying to one of the South African journalists, actually, we did a podcast, I said, South Africa, what do you think about their future? Are you quite pessimistic about it? He said, no, not too much, you know. And I thought, well, that was a bit of South African optimism. But they've come here and this summer and shown, there's lots of talent in that South African side. And they've drubbed England a couple of times in this, yeah.
I'll tell you, Simon, just to add grist to that mill of yours, I got a call from Giles White, who's the director of cricket at Hampshire and at the Southern Brave, and I'm chairman of the Southern Brave in the 100, saying that Marcus Stoinis was likely to miss the last three games of the Brave's campaign, and that he and Mahela had had Mahela's, Giles Warden was the coach, had a chat because they couldn't get hold of me because he needed to move quickly, and they were keen to sign Tristan Stubbs. What did I think of that? And I said, who? And they said, Tristan Stubbs. You must know. He's a South African middle order player. I said, my goodness me, I'm embarrassed to say I don't know Tristan Stubbs. They said, well, we think. I said, well, what's he done? Anyway, the long and the short of the story is 4 days later, I turned on the TV. He got 70. He got 70 in about 15 balls. And I rang him up. I said, good time, boys.
So that's sign him up.
South Africa is still producing. Yeah. I mean, and Lungi Ngidi, how's his bowling under pressure? In really, really difficult situations. He does it every time. I mean,
and he looks as if he loves it, doesn't he? He looks as if he really relishes it.
He does. Yes, that's what you and I have discussed this often. And you used to bowl for Middlesex at the death, under pressure on big occasions. And you got collared once at Lord's in the final. But think of all the other times you pulled it off because you wanted to have a crack at it. Your character.
Absolutely. It's a great challenge. Look, if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. There's nothing you can do about it. But it's exciting because you can have an influence. In a way, you know, bowlers, I mean, batsmen can win a game with, you know, three sixes or something. But it's difficult for bowlers to win games of short form cricket, really, because you just don't have enough overs for a start. But if you can have those last two or three overs in a game where you can turn the tables and win a game, you can be a hero and actually... It's just a very exciting opportunity, I think.
It's like the, you watch in rugby nowadays, and when they turn over ball, when the tide's against them, they all pat each other on the back, celebrating. Way that when you started to bowl a dot ball under pressure, everybody would applaud you like you were here. You'd bowl a dot ball. You know, it was almost like taking a wicket in the championship. You know, it was massive under pressure, needing, you know, what we thought was a difficult chase then, eight and over, say, seven and over. And if you bowled a dot ball, that became eight and a half or whatever it was, you know, you pushed it up and everybody celebrated. So bowlers, it's funny how that balance has changed, that, you know, the role of a bowler as perceived previously was to take wickets by doing something with the ball, a great catch, whatever. Now you can take wickets in these contests by creating a certain pressure, bowling specifically to certain fields, and building dot balls. And you bowl two or three in a row, and in 2020 cricket, you've got a great chance of taking a wicket after that. Anyway,
so just to be clear, Mark, have you signed Tristan Stubbs? You've signed him.
Well,
very good.
Whether he's signed on the dotted line. He has had an approach, I'm told, from London Spirit as well. But my team tell me that I needn't be concerned. Right. So tomorrow morning I might be looking very foolish, but I hope not, because the boys are practicing together today and they will be talking about it. Obviously, Stubbs and Quinton de Kock, who's also in our group, are going. That they've got two games against Ireland this week, so they missed the first game, which is on Wednesday night, and they're available for the second game. From what I gather, he's going to be on board.
Listen, I'm really excited. This is why I wanted you to talk today, because, you know, never mind your great knowledge and love of Test cricket and all other cricket, really. The 100 was something you were very, very closely attached to last year as chairman of the Southern Brave, and you came out winners, and you very kindly invited me and my family to watch the final at Lord's. And I just remember actually sitting with you during that final last year between Southern Brave and Birmingham Phoenix, and both of us sort of steeped in Test cricket, and that being our sort of number one love in the game. But both of us saying, as we were watching, I think it was George Garton and Timal Mills hurling them down at Liam Livingstone and Moeen Ali in sort of 100-mile-an-hour cricket and some incredible fielding, and us, well, you actually saying, this is some of the most exciting cricket I've ever seen. Do you recall that? And do you agree with that?
Yes, and I was asked in by Tom Harrison and Sanjay Patel, going back to a winter 3 years ago, right, before, on a very wintry day, a very cold day, they wanted me to come and see something, and I didn't know what they wanted me to come and see. And I sat in one of the ECB's rooms, darkened for the occasion, big cinema screen up, and they played me a 3 minute or 2 minute or 4 minute promo of what transpired to be a new cricket concept. And when it finished, the screen went to black, and then the two words in white set against the black came up, the 100, which was the summary of what I'd just seen and the title of the idea. And it was quite a complex piece of filmmaking, because it had to have all the necessary graphics that could show the stats, that could show the differences, that could explain the regulations and rules. That, you know, it was a complex thing to produce, and it had a bit of action, but it had a lot of explanation. It was very good. And I just sat there and I said, wow, I love it. I just loved it. And I don't know why. I never fell in love with T20 cricket at the beginning. It took me a long time. And I think possibly it was because I could easily see the threat to the longer form of the game. And I loved 50-over cricket. I've always been a huge 50-over cricket fan. And maybe I could see the threat. Maybe then T20 broke the ice of the threat. And I've seen how it's evolved. And I could see the 100 as a slightly more complex, cleverer game. I liked it. I think you've got to be a little sharper and broader thinking as a captain. I think you've got to have options as a bowler. I love the fact that, you know, if you've got a top class new ball bowler, he can bowl 20 of the first 25 balls, because you can bowl 10 from, you can bowl 20 balls total, and you can bowl 10 from one end in a row. So you bowl your 10, then someone bowls 5 the other, and you can bowl 10 more. So if you were Glenn McGrath or Malcolm Marshall running through a side, you could keep bowling for 20 balls out of the first 25. I think that's helps to redress the balance between bat and ball. And I've never been a one to worry about formats. You know, we grew up, Yoz, we played 40-over cricket, 55-over cricket, 60-over cricket, four-day cricket, or three-day cricket it was then.
20-over? I played 20-over cricket in club cricket.
No,
I meant
professionally,
yeah.
Though.
No, right. Oh, yeah, okay, sure, yeah,
we
sure.
Played 40-over cricket, 55-over cricket, 60-over cricket, three-day cricket, there was five-day cricket in test matches, and we played festival cricket. We fitted in the TN Pierce Festival or the Scarborough, whatever it was, and we'd play festival cricket over 50 overs. There were a lot of formats of the game, and each one of them was as good as each other, because it's not about format. It's about balance between bat and ball. People get far too uptight about format. When we grew up, you'd play cricket for 10 minutes. In the yard or the street. We both lived in West London as we grew up, and I played in the street, and we drew stumps on the bricks, if we just got 10 minutes in, yeah, we loved it. Bat and ball in hand. I don't think formats are an issue. It's the balance between bat and ball. The big problem is too much cricket. Now, the too much cricket applies to the international players more than it applies to the first-class players. The first-class players don't want much less cricket, actually. when you really sit them down and say, well, if it was only a nine-match championship, there were 10 teams and only nine matches in the final, and if we knocked out one-day competition, this is how much you play, they'd go, oh, no, I'm ready for a bit more than that. So I think the balance of the argument is not always fairly put. I don't think formats are the issue.
Of course, it's actually, not going back that far, we had double wicket and single wicket competitions as well, which were televised. Now, I remember the double wicket competitions in the early 80s. I remember Clive Rice playing with Richard Adley against, you know, Garth Larue and Imran Khan or something like that. I mean, you know, the great thing about cricket is it is so versatile and adaptable in a way. And it's cricket. It's still cricket, isn't it? As you say, the balance between bat and ball is the key to it.
I remember Proctor against Botham in those single wicket things. I also remember, this is a slightly bizarre story, there was a local businessman in Bristol. He's about 45 years old, and he challenged Mike Proctor to get him out after a day of championship cricket. And I remember the crowd stayed on to watch it. This bloke who's like padded up, he's like balding and a bit rotund, and Procky running in from the pavilion end at Bristol trying to get him out. He had six balls to get him out. There was a wager on it. And amazingly, he didn't get him out. He managed to, by hook or by crook, he managed to resist him. I think his name, this is going back in the day, John Tutton or someone like that. Anyway, it wasn't quite like that Brett Lee against Piers Morgan thing that we saw in Australia. But all sorts of cricket.
In complete contrast, Simon, I was on trial at Hampshire. And in those days, you did a lot of proper ground staff days. And we ran the scoreboard. And I was in the scoreboard with Tim Tremlett and I think Paul Terry. And we were sort of helping the main man put the numbers up when Mike Proctor got 4 in 5 in the 1977 Benson Edges Cup semi-final. Barry Richards, Gordon Greenidge, John Rice and Trevor Jesty. And he actually got 5 in 6 because the
didn't give him out, did he? He didn't give him out.
It was the most LBW of the lot. Yeah. And Tommy Spencer didn't have the courage to get his finger up. I think his arm was tired. He was aging by then. So Mike Proctor, ironically, along perhaps with, I would say, Wuzzy McGrath, could do more fast damage because of the swing, the late swing, Wacker units, the reverse swingers, and Procky. So it's extraordinary he didn't get an amateur out in 6 attempts. But of course, there's no adrenaline. You're not really running in. You're running in to prove to the chap you're trying a bit. You're not really. You know. Yeah. Anyway, enough.
Yeah, I just want to go back on Tristan Stubbs for a moment because he strikes me as being such an interesting young cricketer. Because I didn't know.
Oh, but he took an amazing catch.
He did. He did. Didn't he? Yeah, brilliant.
Jaunty Rose like.
Wonderful catch. Because I actually thought, you know, I know he played a couple of games in the IPL, didn't he? He was brought in for Tim Al Mills. So when Tim Al Mills was injured, they said, rather than having a quick bowler or bowler, we'll bring in this batter, Tristan Stubbs. And he came, he had 2 innings, he made 2 and 0. But I thought, actually, you know, for South Africa to come over to England and play a 21-year-old at number 6, I thought, this guy must have something about him. And his over went for 20, bowled a no ball, and, you know, it was disappearing around the park. What did you think when you were watching him? Did you think this guy is a new start on the block, or is it too early to say? You know, you're actually putting a lot on someone's shoulders, and you say, well, wait till he faces. You talk about, you know, you were talking about quality bowling in the 100, there, 20, the first 25 balls. If he comes up against a top class bowler or top class spinner, say in Indian conditions in the IPL, it's going to be much harder for him. That actually there was perhaps a bit of fodder around the other evening, and he had a bit of license as well. Or is this guy potentially in the next big star or one of the next big stars?
Well, I would, it's a really good question. I would say that you shouldn't rush into judgment in a quick 70 in a T20 game. Mm-hmm. But I would say that a lot of what you need to achieve at the highest level is in your head, is temperament, is the ability to cope. And he looks to me like he's got that. I think to go in and grab a game, albeit I know England didn't bowl as well as they can bowl and all that sort of stuff, you've still got to have the mindset to do it. And I would say that was the most encouraging thing about that performance. And seeing his fielding since, I think he's wholly engaged in the match. He's not a mental drifter. He's a focused cricketer, capable of moments of magic. And so I would say he's more likely to go on and be a great success than not.
Actually, it reminds me of his performance. Reminds me of, do you remember Jos Buttler coming into bat for England at Edgbaston in a very early in his career, if not the first game, it must have been one of his first games. And I think it was against South Africa. And he just had this sort of outrageous panache and daredevilry about his... He walked right across outside off and flicked someone over short fine leg and clattered a couple back over the bowler's head into the pavilion. You know, he made his mark, batting probably at number six, very early on in his T20 career. And, you know, you sort of looked at that and thought, blimey, you know, that's talent. Now can he kind of add to it, show some consistency? What happens when he comes up against a good bowler? Well, we've seen the answers there.
Yeah, I don't get why he's not. I mean, he's such a well-organised player, and you think that his mind's good. It's funny, I thought Ed Smith got it right picking him in the test side, and I didn't mind that he picked him at number seven. I mean, people made so much of that. He was just batting one behind the wicketkeeper, who was then Bairstow. Bairstow was six and he was seven. I couldn't see the difference. Okay, well, we'll swap around then. And does that make you all happy that he's been picked at six, not at seven, you know? And he played a couple of innings, not just here, by the way. He played really well on England's tour of Sri Lanka 4 years ago. Really well. I mean, I think it was in Kandy, he played a couple of innings. In the first innings, he drove the ball very straight. And as the pitch began to spin, so he started to adapt his game, so much so that for most of the second innings, he only hit it square of the wicket. So in the first innings, flat pitch, seamers bowling a bit fuller, everybody, but he just hit the ball down the ground. He didn't sweep or reverse sweep at all. Second innings, totally different innings against the same attack. Lots of works off his body, lots of orthodox sweeps and reverse sweeps, much more imagination to the innings. It seems to me he's got it. I don't know why he hasn't transferred that into Test cricket, really. I mean, he's got a few technical flaws.
I think it's partly the sort of... I think it's all about planning an innings. And, you know, what's the tempo? How do I play the first 20 balls? You know, how do I build from... You know, we had Joe Root on this show about a year and a half ago when he was gone through that difficult trot and he'd made no hundreds in a year and, you know, hadn't been able to convert small starts into big scores. And he went and examined his dismissals between 0 and 40, or between 30 and 40 and 70 and 80 sort of thing, and how do you get out those various times. And I don't think in fact I looked at those dismissals, how he got out between sort of 20 and 40 and say 60 and 80, and there was no pattern. It was just various ways of getting out. So in the end it was mental. It was about going back to basics every time you get past 50 and just sort of almost shutting it out and carrying on. I mean, you know, you're a former batsman, you would know more about this, really. But isn't it about knowing how to construct an innings, really, in Test cricket, which some people have an ability to do, Root being one, although he's had his dips, and Cook, obviously, another, in English circles anyway. And it's about having that kind of structure almost subconsciously to create that sort of rhythm and flow and consistency.
Well, actually, Yoz, in this particular instance, although I agree with your overall principle, in this particular instance, I'd take a slightly different view, which would be that Root did have a technical issue. And that because he'd got a bit front on the back foot, his hands were getting away from his body outside off something. He was feeling for the ball. I think he got out a lot, just sort of looking to run the ball outside off something, because one of the great strengths of his batting is the way he keeps the scoreboard moving, and he then begins to dominate the tempo of the match. He was forcing that rather than it being natural, and that was creating an error. So he in lockdown, he talked about getting more alongside the, which is something that another former England captain, Ted Dexter, had urged him to do in some emails. Stay alongside the ball and don't let the hands get away from the body. And I think he worked very hard on that. I don't think Roots ever had a problem mentally getting organized to play in innings. What I think Root would be really good at doing is helping other people. And I wonder how much he's spoken to Butler about exactly that. Constructing an innings is very important. And of course, it's totally different every day. You may have the right idea. Brian Lara always used to say the bowler's got 40 minutes. But if I'm still out there after 40 minutes, good luck. Joe might say, I want to be scoring from the off. I don't know what he says. Ben Stokes at the moment says, I'll hit it out of the park first ball if it's there to hit. People have got different ways of doing it. I feel that Joss, I think you've summed it up well. He's not worked out the best way to play in innings. Shane Warne almost had him thinking right. You know, Warne told him after he worked with him for the Rajasthan Royals that he was a unique talent, not just special, unique in the world. He didn't think anybody, not Warner, not Kohli, anybody, could consistently strike the ball so cleanly anywhere. So Warne said to him, just limit the spaces you hit it in Test cricket, pick your areas and continue to attack. Don't have to take undue risk. You can score off length, you can score off width, you can score off anything. And he made him feel amazing. And he played pretty well in Test cricket when Ed first brought him back in that role. And then as he had more success in the short form, so he began to have less success in the long form. Anyway, we could talk about him for a long time because he is so gifted, isn't he?
I'm just going to go back to that innings I mentioned actually a while ago. It was in 2012 and September. It was the third T20 of the South Africa tour, and he came in at number 5 in a shortened match actually, and he got 32 not out off 10 balls. with 2 4s and 3 6s, and in the South Africa, this is 2012. The South African attack was included Morney Morkel, Jacques Callis played in that as well. So you know he always set out to be pretty unique. And
commentating on that, do you remember that 130 or 140 at Lords?
Yeah.
When they were playing, he was hitting it over extra cover. That was quite early.
Sri Lanka, I think, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, amazing. Amazing. Anyway, there you go. There's Josh. Josh. God, stop saying that. Josh.
Well, we talked a little bit about Joss Butler before the break. I mean, he's in a difficult situation now. England have really struggled. Ben Stokes has come into the test side as captain and seemingly transformed it straight away. Owen Morgan's gone. Joss Butler's in. England are losing and losing quite heavily. I mean, surely it's inconceivable that they would change captain before the T20 World Cup, isn't it? I mean, they have to keep on going. The coach yesterday, Matthew Mott, was talking about this is a line in the sand, keep going, trying to find some form in the 100 and see where it takes them. They've got lots of matches in Pakistan, 7 and then 3 against Australia before the T20 World Cup. I mean, surely it's inconceivable that he won't be captain, isn't it, for the first match in the T20 World Cup?
Well, I'm not sure it's inconceivable. I think it's unlikely. There's no pattern of England making dramatic changes in the modern era. Matthew Mott is a highly respected and knowledgeable guy. This team doesn't have any imprint of Matthew Mott yet. It's very much the team that he's inherited from Owen Morgan.
Which is a bit like 2015, isn't it? It's a bit like Alistair Cook getting dumped as captain at the end of 2014. And Owen Morgan inheriting that team in the 2015 World Cup, and obviously, you know, it was an absolute calamity. But then, you know, he had the chance then to build the team after that.
Yeah, but Morgan completely changed England's approach to the game. I don't think there's any need to do that. I think England have got the right manner, fashion of playing the game. They've just got players out of form. And our question is it too much for Joss to be captain, wicketkeeper and opening batsman? And I think that's a very demanding role. And I MS Dhoni didn't open the batting. I think 2020 in the field for a captain is hugely demanding. It moves very quickly. It's very hard to recover from mistakes. You're very dependent on luck. I mean, it's incredible how some days it goes with one team and against the other. So much so that you see one team nick everything through the slips for four under pressure in the death overs, and the opposing team nick none and either miss them or nick them to the keeper. So I think it's a lot. If you're in the field for 20 overs and then you've got to go out and open the batting, I think it's pretty demanding on you mentally. And I would question whether it's the right job for him, but it's probably a job he wants to do very much and make the best of. And I would think he's going to get the first run at it, isn't he? I mean, why are they playing seven ODIs in Pakistan before playing a World Cup in Australia? I mean, one country the ball bounces knee height, and the other it bounces throat height. It's sort of slightly an odd place to go to. But they obviously owe Pakistan a thank you, and they committed to seven games. I think it's a pity there aren't 5 and 5, really. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I don't think it's inconceivable, Simon. I think it is possible. I think Moeen Ali's ready to go as an option. Very successful with Worcester, highly respected, a tremendous move for English cricket in a number of ways. And I bang on about James Vince because I'm a fan.
Well, yeah, I'd like to pick you up on James Vince because we should just talk a little bit about the 100, which is obviously starting this week, second episode of, if you like. And you were saying earlier, James Vince was someone that you were very impressed by his handling of the Southern Brave, who obviously ended up winning the tournament. How much was Vince actually influential in that success? And what did he do?
Well, Mahela Jayawardene thinks he's the best captain he's worked with. He's very calm under pressure. He can think laterally if he needs to. He's respected by his bowlers, which is very important. In other words, he understands them. I think he's got a lovely little knack. You know when you had it because you played under Mike Brearley. That little knack for seeing something before anybody else sees it. I think that's a nice little, I'm watching, you saw me at Lords, I watched those games very closely. And I'm thinking, what would I do now? And a sort of thing. And he suddenly does something. I think, oh, that's a good idea. So I think he's got something. I really do. But he's a very understated, shy guy. And something that's been levelled at him, not so much as an accusation, but as an observation, is that perhaps he doesn't want the spotlight. You know, some people don't revel in the spotlight. Others die for the spotlight, demand the spotlight. And he doesn't at all. And maybe the spotlight diminishes him a bit. I don't know what his choice would be. I'll probably ask him over the next month. Who would not want to captain England in a format of any format of the game? And I'm sure he'd say, no, I'd love to. But what would he think deep down? I don't know. I don't know. I need to find out more. But I was really impressed. His batting, of course, when he's on, he's in the best two or three in the land and the best 15 or 20 in the world. But he nicks the ball to the slips, and that leads to a lot of criticism. His last innings, his last substantial innings for England was when he was brought into the one-day side last summer when 11 players were changed, if you remember, at the last minute because of COVID issues. Ben Stokes was recalled to captain the team, even with his bad hand. And Vince made 100 against Pakistan at Edgbaston. He batted, Zach Crawley got 50 the other end. And I know Zach Crawley a bit. I'm a mate of his dad. And I said to Zach, how was it batting with Vincey? And he just looked at me and went, oh, my God. he's just so good. He's so good. He was almost shocked by, when you bat, it's quite funny how when you bat with someone, you see more of them. When you look at them only from the opponent's eye, you're always searching for a way to get them out. And so you think you found a flaw or they hurt you so much, you go off them anyway. But when you bat with someone, you go, oh, my goodness me, how good is this guy? Because you can't do that. And he can.
And you're talking as a former batsman who made a lot of first-class hundreds. Imagine what it's like for me at the other end to, you know, Dean Jones or Mike Gatting or somebody, or Desmond Haynes. Imagine, oh, God. I mean, you just marvel. You marvel at the ability of those guys.
Ren from Gordon, Greenwich from Robin Smith. Don't worry, there's perspective from me too, Yoss. And David Gowan when he came down. Actually.
God. Bloody hell. Yeah.
Well, I had to bowl at the bloke. That was worse. Anyway, just to sort of finish today, and you know, thanks for all your thoughts. It's really been really interesting. Just let's look ahead a bit. The announcement last week of the new South African T20, which is scheduled to start in January. You're kind of caught up in that in a way because of your involvement with SuperSport, the broadcaster that has bought the rights to that tournament. You know, tell us a little bit about the formation of it and the prospects for it, and maybe what you think the impact on the rest of the world game is.
Well, South Africa tried to bring in a short form league, not privately owned, but privately owned teams, but run by the governing body and owned by the governing body. A while back, it was called the Mzansi Super League. It didn't really take off. Whether that's because they didn't market it right, whether that's because the standard of player wasn't good enough, whether that's because there were no overseas players, so it didn't have that extra sparkle and impetus, whether that's because in most cases their best cricketers, the international players, weren't available to play in it. I don't know. It could be any number of reasons. Some of the pitches weren't great. Maybe there wasn't enough care and preparation put into the overall planning of the tournament. You know, there were lots of reasons that the Mzansi Super League didn't quite, there was some chaos in cricket South Africa. You know, lots of reasons it didn't quite work. So they went on hold, and an idea was bubbling all the time in SuperSport to be behind a new short form tournament. SuperSport really could see the value in having a narrative for 3 weeks or a month with the best players in the country. Finding a window was difficult, and has remained so, by the way, because we're seeing overload in the game, and the spread of the IPL, although not necessarily a bad thing for cricket, depending on how you look at where the game is going next, the fact is that it's blocking a lot of other things happening. And it's ironic that there are IPL owners in, you know, burgeoning tournaments elsewhere, notably South Africa and the UAE. I'm going on too long here. So South Africa was ready for it. And all they needed was to find the moment, find private backers, find a cricket South Africa that were better organised, find a tournament director. And this all came together with a very good new CEO at Cricket South Africa, with Graham Smith stepping down as director of cricket and therefore being available to run this tournament. An extraordinary man, in my view, hugely respected globally, and an absolute modern builder of South African cricket. SuperSport ready to effectively pay for it if need be, and these private buyers champing at the bit. So in a very short space of time, even though there's been 3 years of chat along the idea, in a very short space of time, they were able to spot this window in starting on January the 12th, I think it is, and moving for about just under a month. It may be that, you know, we know the Big Bash will be on at the same time, but it may be that the UAE Super League is at the same time. Well, that may push back a bit. I would have thought there must be talk about that, given that a lot of the same owners are now owning teams in both events. And of course, the South African players are thrilled because, you know, compared to other countries, they're not paid especially well, but therefore, you know, they can't take their round anywhere else. They certainly can't take it out of South Africa. Some big name players are coming to play. We've already read that Butler and Livingston, for example, have signed. I heard a whisper the other day about Morgan maybe playing. I don't know. I genuinely don't know whether that's true or not. I read it somewhere. So I think it's got a nice impetus. Regards its impact in South Africa, what's absolutely crucial right now in South Africa is quickly for cricket to relate to African children. Because I'm not literally saying take a game into the townships, but I think you probably should if you can. If you could find a stadium that can be suitably converted with a drop-in pitch or a hybrid pitch, I think you should. Because inherently in Africa, there must be an incredible amount of talent lying dormant. And I think the aim is to use the funding, a ring-fenced amount of the funding from this tournament, along with the profile of this tournament, to fire up interest in the game amongst kids in communities that are really football dedicated, and see if they can uncover players from that. So the reasons behind it are good. I think the money will be put to good use. I don't think that it'll be wasted money or money that disappears or whatever. I think this money will be well applied to all the things South African cricket needs right now, which is projects at participation and development level, pathways created, and a general feel that the game is for everybody in South Africa, not just for a limited, lucky few.
I suppose one of the headlines sort of outside of South Africa is the fact that the owners are all IPL owners, and people are saying the IPL, for want of a better phrase, is taking over. You know, they'll buy up every franchise, and then you'll have year-long contracts. Tim Widmore wrote a good piece, interesting piece, speaking to one of the IPL owners the other day in the Telegraph, saying that the idea is to have 12-month contracts. You know, you basically have, a bit like football, I suppose, you play for one franchise thread throughout the year. And then the knock-on consequence is, what does that mean? I suppose people are saying, what does that mean for international cricket? I wonder what it does mean for the future of international cricket.
Well, we don't know, Simon. This thing is moving so fast. There's so much talk of the death of bilateral cricket, you know, soon enough. The spiraling impact of the IPL is exponential and inevitable, as far as I can see. And my only surprise is it's taken everybody so long to react. I can't believe that English cricket hasn't looked at private investment. I read a piece in the Cricketer magazine hammering the idea of a private investment into English cricket. I don't think we've got any choice. We can't keep relying on masses of television money. We need much more money. You talked about my role with Chance to Shine. So we have to make 5.8 million a year to keep Chance to Shine going. And we're in a bit more than half the schools in the country. I mean, we need more money to have young people play the game. We still don't really get to the kind of communities that we should do. We should do more with Asian communities, both through existing projects and new projects. We need more money. Now, that money has to be ring-fenced and very carefully used for the right projects. Private investment is the only way to get it. And I think it's essential. And we'll miss the boat. We missed the boat with T20 at the start, and we'll miss the boat again unless we move quickly now. And there's lots of people want to own teams in this country, and they're not all Indians. So I think it's inevitable that that's the way that the game will go. Support will become driven a little bit more like it is in football by the club, not the country. But, and here's the rub, if we can keep Test cricket as the pinnacle, it will still be English cricket or England cricket that matters most to us. The problem isn't doing it here. I believe it'll last here for as long as the game lasts. The problem is elsewhere. And if it really is only England and India playing it, then we have a problem. It's expensive to play. There aren't a lot of new players that are gagging for it in the way they used to. Four-day cricket is enormously expensive to run, like a penny, really. So it's hard. If we can keep Test cricket alive and well, I believe that this country specifically will continue to look after it, and the national team will be more important than any private enterprise, even though they will also be important.
I'd just say to add to that a couple of things. I mean, firstly, I can see these T20 leagues competing with each other a bit. So there'll be, as you mentioned, there'll be a sort of parallel tournament in Australia and South Africa, and they'll have to scrap over the best players. And that's just a feature of market forces in a way. I think there'll be windows for Test cricket still kept very separate, so that the T20 domestic leagues have to fit into their own sort of slot in the calendar, and there is a window still for Test cricket. And I'd say one other thing just about this sort of 12-month potential contracts for players, or at least franchise contracts for players, which allows them to play some international cricket but also attaches them to a particular franchise in various territories. I'd say one thing about that, and I'll just repeat what Rahul Dravid said about the IPL. He said there are less victims of cricket now. And what he meant by that was that the IPL facilitated perhaps 80 Indian cricketers the chance to play in big stadiums in front of large audiences at international or effectively similar level to international sport. And it was a wonderful opportunity for many of those young players. And in a way, these T20 leagues are creating opportunities for other young players from those countries. You're restricted if your ambition is only to play for your country, that can only accommodate 14 or 15 or 17 or 18 cricketers from your country, whereas a very high profile domestic league like the South Africa one or the IPL or the 100 can create opportunity, earning opportunity, exposure opportunity, playing opportunity for 70, 80, maybe even 100 young or middle-aged players in that country. And I think that's to be celebrated.
Yeah, I endorse that completely. And I would just come back to your first point about a clashing of the leagues. I'm not worried about that at all. Serie A, La Liga, the Bundesliga, they all exist alongside the Premier League all winter long. And standards are very high. And the best players get the best contracts at the best clubs. And spaces are created at all these clubs for players to emerge that we've never heard of. And suddenly they're playing for England. We've had a couple who played in Germany and they've suddenly come back to play for England. I think that for me, it's a bigger and better and more global game all the time. And I think it's incredibly exciting. And yes, it does lean slightly towards the lowest common denominator in terms of the cricket played. Which is why, if you're right, and windows for Test cricket can be found, and it's preserved and nurtured, and there's this, I mean, it's never been more thrilling to watch Test cricket than it is these days compared to, we started, not only were we watching black and white TV, but the cricket felt like black and white. It was pretty dull, it was pretty plain, but not anymore. Mm. It's very exciting. And I think if we look after that, wow, I think cricket can be a stronger force for good going forward than perhaps it's ever been.
So what we're saying, just sort of roughly what we're saying, is that we can see a situation in the future where a player is contracted to one franchise thread and is released, a bit like football at the moment, released to play for your international team, certain occasions, World Cups, T20 World Cups, and perhaps a limited amount of Test cricket. Is that what we're talking about? Or actually, is there room for both in the sense that, because now we talked about this before, Yos, haven't we, how the white ball game and the red ball game are diverging. And actually, you look at the England team at the moment, there aren't that many people playing in the England red ball team that play in the England white ball team. So where are we on this as final point to ruminate on?
I would have thought that there will be an option. You can either be attached to one franchise thread or you can be freelance. And I think that's a fantastic opportunity for young players. So there'll be a way in the door. And I think they have to make windows for Test cricket. And I think England are in a very strong position as being the major Northern Hemisphere base for the game. So I think that for England going forward, I think cricket in this country, there will be more opportunities rather than fewer.
Great. Well, that's a good positive note to end on. Just want to say, thanks very much for your time and your thoughts today. Mark, and fascinating to see how the Southern Brave do and also how the South African League behaves as well. And there's a lot of interesting developments there. Actually, you mentioned right at the start the success of the South African cricket team, bearing in mind, and this was something that Vincent van der Bijl in our last podcast talked about, that only 6% of South African schools play after schools cricket or any sport, in fact. So the performance of the South Africans in, say, rugby and cricketing circles is extraordinary given the small number of players they actually have access to. So that's remarkable.
Another reason why this new league is a very good idea to try to attract more children to the game. Listen, thank you for having me. It's really fun to talk to you both.
Our next guest is actually Wayne Larkins, who you will remember playing against. And I often think of, if there's anybody that has the same sort of natural skills as Jos Buttler in our era, it could be Wayne Larkins, actually, who once, you'll recall, probably yourself, hit Malcolm Marshall first ball of a game straight over extra cover for six, didn't he? Is that true?
No. It's better than that. It's not of the game. So here's the introduction for your next podcast. So we needed to win to beat you in the championship race in 1985. Last game of the season was at home against Northants on a deck that even by Northlands road standards was too flat. And I declared early, leaving Northants 246 to win the game in ages. I mean, I probably declared before lunch, certainly. And they all looked at me, the guys, as if to say, you're kidding. And I said, we've just got to get bowling. We need all the time to take the wickets. They get the runs, they get the runs. We'll bowl them out if we bowl well. And they all, even Marshall, looked at me as if to say, what's he done now, the mad idiot? And he ran in, the world's greatest fast bowler, sprinted into Ned, as we called him, Wayne Larkins, and needing 246 in 4 hours, he hit the first ball straight over extra cover for six, like a shell. I mean, flat, hard, off that white wall. And they all looked at me and said, nice declaration, skipper. Again, the match went to the last ball. This is a true story. The match went to the last ball, 6 to win, 9 down. And Roger Harper hit it over the side screen.
Oh my God. What a game.
Bowled by Raj Maru. And I said,
that was brave. Last over with bowled by Raj Maru. That was brave bit of captaincy.
Yeah, well, and I said, just spin it. Don't worry about anything else. Pitch it wherever you like. He'll probably run down the pitch. Maybe bowl it into the surface and get it and rip it. And he bowled it into the surface and spun it. And he rocked onto the back foot and hit it straight over the side screen. And there was silence in our dressing room for 10 minutes and everybody peeled off their boots and wiped their brow and knew the championship was certainly gone to Middlesex again until it was broken by Gordon Greenwich saying, which idiot told him to bowl it there? There you go.
Oh, well, you know, legions of stories from the cricket world. We could talk forever, but we've all got to go because, for one thing, I've got to go and have a penalty shootout against my daughter, and I know I'm going to lose. So I'll report back on the outcome of that and speak to you next time. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Podcast Network.